The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
You will see that this talk was billed as Martin Luther King in the 50s. So if any of you are here for the wrong decade, then I'm sorry about that. It will be the 60s. And I'm gonna start with a short reading from the book, because it really captures the mood of the beginning of the decade, and we see kind of what King is has to deal with. And the first first person I quote is a guy called Franklin McCain. Franklin McCain was one of three young men in Greensboro, North Carolina, who made his stand by taking his seat at the Woolworths. And I interviewed Franklin McCain back in 1997, and it was one of the most electrifying interviews I did. This was when I was going through the Deep South on Greyhound, which I don't recommend. Franklin McCain was saying that he grew up as a teenager hating his parents, not for the regular reasons that teenagers hate their parents, but because by the time he got to 17, he realized that they had lied to him, and they'd lied to him by saying, you can do anything you want to do. You can be anything that you want to be. And he realized that his life as a young black man in North Carolina was worthless. He felt it was worthless. It even contemplated suicide. And he said in late years he realized that his parents were trying to protect him. But when he worked out what that lie was, he said it was a cruel lie. And the discovery of that lie was cruel. And so he gets together with his friends in their dorm at A&T in Greensboro, a historically black college. And they talk themselves into a lather about how they haven't done anything. And so they resolve to go the next day to the Woolworths. And they just decide this on their own. And Franklin said, we wanted to go beyond what our parents had done, and the worst thing that could happen was that the Ku Klux Klan could kill us. But I had no concern for my personal safety. The day I sat at the counter, I had the most tremendous feeling of elation and celebration. I felt that in this life, nothing else mattered. If there's a heaven, I got there for a few minutes. I just felt, you can't touch me. You can't hurt me. There's been no other experience like it, not even the birth of my first child. A few years later, in May 63 in Birmingham, a burly white police officer attempted to intimidate some black school children to keep them from joining the growing protests. They assured him they knew what they were doing, ignored his entreaties, and continued their march toward Kelly Ingram Park, where they were arrested. A reporter asked one of them her age as she climbed into the paddy wagon. 6, she said. The following month in Mississippi, stalwart civil rights campaigner Fannie Lou Hamer overheard Anel Ponder, a fellow activist, being beaten in a jail in an adjacent cell. Can you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir, the policeman demanded. Yes, I can, replied Ponder. So say it. I don't know you well enough, said Ponder. And then Hamer heard her head hit the floor again. All books, wrote the late Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuscinski, about all revolutions begin with a chapter that describes the decay of tottering authority or the misery and sufferings of the people. But they should begin with a psychological chapter, one that shows how a harassed, terrified man suddenly breaks his terror and stops being afraid. This unusual process demands illuminating. Man gets rid of fear and feels free. The period preceding King's speech at the March on Washington was one such chapter. Until that point, there had, of course, been many fearless acts by anti-racist protesters. But in that moment, the number who were prepared to commit them reached a critical mass. In May 63, the New York Times published more stories about civil rights in 2 weeks than it had in the previous 2 years. During a 10-week period following Kennedy's national address on civil rights in June, there were 758 demonstrations in 186 cities, resulting in 14,733 arrests. And the context was global. 2 days after McCain made his protest in Greensboro, the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan addressed the South African Parliament in Cape Town with an ominous warning. "The wind of change is blowing through this continent," he said, "and whether we like it or not, the growth of national consciousness is a political fact." Some, including his immediate apartheid audience, did not like it at all. But as the decade wore on, that wind became a gale. In the 3 years between Macmillan's speech and the March on Washington, the following countries became independent: Togo, Mali, Senegal, Zaire, Somalia, Benin, Niger, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Chad, Central African Republic, Congo, Gabon, Nigeria, Mauritania, Sierra Leone, Tanganyika, and Jamaica. Internationally, non-racial democracy and the black enfranchisement that came with it were the order of the day. The longer America practiced legal segregation, the more it looked like a slum on the wrong side of history than a shining city on the hill. So that was the beginning of the decade. Fannie McCain really starts that decade in February with a protest. And what's important to understand about that particular protest is it's three kids on their own. That this was a period when the base kept moving away from the leadership of all the civil rights organizations, leaving them running to catch up. The March on Washington in 63, at the beginning of 63, nobody wants a march. The National Urban League are worried about their tax status. The NAACP wants a conference with Kennedy. Their understanding of politics in that moment of the civil rights leadership is very limited to kind of what they can wrest from this rotten system. And then people keep coming out, kids as young as six, and that leaves them running to catch up. So the march at the beginning of the year, which was A. Philip Randolph's brainchild, and Bayard Rustin was the architect of the whole thing. At the beginning of the year, this march is an orphan. By June, it has many parents. Everybody wants to claim this this march. And it's an example of the civil rights leadership really struggling to catch up. When Randolph and King and some of the others go to see Kennedy, and Kennedy asks them to call off the march earlier, saying, you know, we can do this through legislation. Once again, that very limited understanding of what politics is. He says, "We want action in Congress, not a big show with Negroes in the streets." And A. Philip Randolph says to him, "The Negroes are already in the streets, Mr. President, and I doubt if we called them that they would come back." Now, that was partly a rebuke to the president, but it's partly an indication actually of the weakness of the leadership, that or the degree to which the leadership is out of touch. This thing explodes. And King is at the center of the explosion. He starts the decade actually not doing too well. Montgomery bus boycott is 5 years before. And he's in Albany, Georgia. And basically he's outmaneuvered by the state. And he's looking for a new win, a place where he can strike. And a large section of the civil rights movement, such as it was, thinks actually that King is washed up. They think he is a showman. And there is this division within the civil rights movement between those who espouse a purely legal strategy, namely the NAACP, National Urban League. National Urban League is also an economic strategy, but a legal strategy that we must do this through the courts. That's the only way, and through legislation, that's the only way that anything is going to change. And then along comes King with, well, first the boycott in Montgomery, and a sense that mass action could work, and also a savvy in terms of what was then new media, meaning television. Now, obviously, television has been around for a while, but there's an explosion in the number of people that have television between the 50s and the mid-60s. And also, television has the capacity now to broadcast live across the world. And King understands all of that way before the other more established leaders. And so he gets into these scrapes. At one stage, Roy Wilkins says to him, what have you ever integrated? You know, we did Brown versus Board of Education. What have you actually really achieved? And Bayard Rustin, somewhat dismissively, says of King that all he needed around him were empty heads and hard asses. Horses that would just sit down when he told them to sit down, and heads that were sufficiently empty that they would do whatever he told them. And so King is not universally embraced or exalted. And when people ask, when I do events about the book, and people often say, you know, so who... where are these speeches happening now? Who's making that kind of speech now, like the I Have a Dream speech? Or who would that be today? And I said, well, Martin Luther King wasn't Martin Luther King until he was blessed by history, right? There was large periods of time when he was marginalized and understood to be a polarizing figure, and people didn't love him. So those speeches are probably being made all over the place, and you're just not listening to the right people. And so during that period, in 63, King, speaking in Harlem, is heckled by youth shouting, "We want Malcolm." And there's a real, real tension between the base and the leadership. Bayard Rustin describes that time. He said, the civil rights movement had reached yet a new stage in its development. For the first time, a thoroughgoing revolution is occurring in the South. The Negro community is now fighting for total freedom. The Negro masses are no longer prepared to wait for anybody. They're going to move. Nothing can stop them. Now, King was the best equipped of the established civil rights leaders. I'm not talking here about SNCC and to some extent CORE, who were both younger and newer and more militant, but compared to the Urban League and the NAACP and the Negro Women's Council, King, with his advocacy of mass action and civil disobedience, going from people who espouse a legal strategy to King saying, fill the jails. So let's turn this open prison of segregation, let's turn being an actual prison into a badge of honor for kids. No more of the respectability and the long march through the institutions. It would take too long and wouldn't bear enough fruit. He's the best equipped to take advantage of this new mood, and he does. First of all, with most probably with Birmingham, and then at the march. And but alongside this, in the global context, alongside these independence movements that were also feeling, because this was one moment when Black America and the rest of the Black diaspora were all having the same conversation: how do we get the vote? And so there was, in, you know, all of those countries that I mentioned, there was a symbiotic relationship between these different freedom movements. They were talking strategies and tactics. King, most his kind of greatest influence being Gandhi. And so the anti-colonial movement very much influencing the civil rights movement, but also it's the Cold War. It's the middle of the Cold War. And America is running around the world lecturing people about democracy, trying to export something that they can't even grow at home. And these images of children being hosed and bitten, and of King, who gets a Nobel Prize in the middle of the decade, being put in prison, and young kids being murdered in Mississippi, that people start asking, with what authority are you speaking? Dean Rusk, Secretary of State at the time, says, our voice is muted, our friends are embarrassed, our enemies are gleeful. We are running this race with one of our legs in a cast. And so this gives ballast and power to the civil rights movement. And King, of all people, very much understands that. He understands that there is leverage in America's weak global position when it comes to moral authority. He says, the US is concerned about its image. When things started happening down here, Mr. Kennedy got disturbed. For Mr. Kennedy is battling for the minds of men in Asia and Africa, some 1 billion in a neutralist sector of the world, and they aren't going to respect the US if she deprives men and women of the basic rights of life because of the color of their skin. Mr. Kennedy knows that. And so this is not just a fight about democracy in America. It is a fight which I think continues for America's moral relevance as any kind of force for good. But then comes 64, Kennedy's assassinated. 64 is the Civil Rights Act. 65, the Voting Rights Act. And the civil rights movement is faced with a challenge, a serious challenge, which is now that the legislation has been passed, how do we take this subject, this issue, forward? Because the way in which the whole thing had been framed now becomes problematic. That really, the issue was never integration and segregation. The South was the most integrated place in America. White men slept, sometimes forcibly, sometimes not, with black women. Black women breastfed white children. Quite often they lived in the same house. It wasn't how close you got, it was how equal. This was a fight against white supremacy. This was a fight for equality. And when the signs come down, that obviously is a very important thing. But that's not the same as equality. And getting rid of segregation is not the same as getting rid of racism. And racism is not just about how non-white people are treated socially. There is an entire economic, political, social system in which it's embedded. And if you are serious about equality, then you have to take on that broader system. And they understood that. And King knew that he could not stop there, that he could not stop with formal equality, that there was more to ending slavery than just the breaking of the chains, that if you want real equality, then that fight is going to have to continue, and it's going to continue in a different way. This is Rustin again in a piece he wrote for Commentary in 65 called From Protest to Power. The civil rights movement is evolving from a protest movement into a fully fledged social movement. An evolution calling its very name into question. It's now concerned not merely with removing the barriers to full opportunity, but with achieving the fact of equality. From sit-ins and freedom rides, we have gone into rent strikes, boycotts, community organization, and political action. And as a consequence of this natural evolution, the Negro today finds himself stymied by obstacles of far greater magnitude than the legal barriers he was attacking before. Automation, urban decay, de facto school segregation. These are problems which, while conditioned by Jim Crow, do not vanish upon its demise. They are more deeply rooted in our socioeconomic order. They are the result of the total society's failure to meet not only the Negro's needs, but human needs generally. And so King moves on in a way that others do not. He is given a very rude example of the degree to which this bigotry is embedded in a broader system when he comes here to Chicago, where they don't have the signs, but they still have the barriers, where you can live as long as you want, so long as you live over there. And he tries to take on Daley, and he's outmaneuvered, not in the same way as he was outmaneuvered in Albany, in a different way, but nonetheless, he is outmaneuvered, and also kind of bruised by, I mean, literally bruised, actually, by the experience. And in 66, he could feel things slipping away. And he says, I need some help in getting this method across, that's nonviolence. They've lost faith in the democratic process. They've lost faith in nonviolence. Those, paraphrasing Kennedy, he said, those who will make this peaceful revolution impossible will make a violent revolution inevitable, and we've got to get this over. I need help. I need some victories. I need concessions. He didn't get the concessions. Those concessions never really came, unless you count the war on poverty as a concession, but it was entirely insufficient. And so he starts taking on the bigger fish, the economic system, and also America's foreign policy, and drawing all of that together. Now, at the beginning of the decade, his approval ratings are, as many Americans approve of him as disapprove, which, if you realize that the overwhelming majority of black Americans love him, then you can see that actually white America was not particularly enamored, but there was enough to mean that nationally, he was on an even keel. But and that carries on through the 60s, even through through the legislation, through the March on Washington and so on. But then he goes off the reservation. He goes away from that area that has been allowed for him by liberal America, this small patch of grass that he's allowed to graze on. He can talk about segregation and he can talk about race, so long as he talks about nonviolence and so on. And when he does, people are there to attack him. And I asked Jack O'Dell, who was one of his lieutenants, why did he make that decision, particularly to speak out about Vietnam, when he knew that it was going to mean a massive, it was going to have a massive impact on the money that the movement got, and on his standing, on his position with Johnson. And Jack O'Dell said, well, he knew that he didn't have long to live. He knew that. He said, we all knew that. And so there were things that he had to say. Now, I don't want to be too, I think that's a very plausible explanation for part of the strategy. I think also, though, that King just is not prepared to stop at the legal. And so he starts talking dirty This is, from where do we go from here? In 66. It says, there are 40 million people here, 40 million poor people here, and one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day, we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? Now, that kind of talk in America will get you killed. And sure enough, within a couple of years, he was dead. Then came the Riverside Church, where he calls America the greatest purveyor of military violence in the world today. And so, as he's coming to the end of his life, twice as many Americans disapprove of him as approve. And if you, once again, you bear in mind African Americans' devotion to him, that means white people hate him. Well, within, what would it be, 45 years or so of that, in 1999, there's a poll of who Americans think were the greatest people of the 20th century. And King comes second only to Mother Teresa. He dies a marginalized and somewhat polarizing figure. The last news reports when he dies in Memphis in 68, mocking him for leading a demonstration at which there was some violence. And so the last news reports, the New York Times said the events were a powerful embarrassment to him. A column in the Dallas Morning News called him the headline-hunting high priest of nonviolent violence. A torchbearer sprinting into a powder house. The Providence Sunday Journal called him reckless and irresponsible. And so when we come to remember King in the 60s, the way that this has happened, there's a great quote from Ernst Renan, a French philosopher, who says, a nation must remember many things, but it must forget many things too in order to be a nation. And so when it came to America remembering King, this was the only way that America could remember King during the 60s, was just to forget the last bit and to have him as a dreamer, to have him as articulating that fantastic moment, which is the end of official American apartheid in 63, and to pretend that the rest didn't happen, because in order to give him the real estate that he now has on the Mall in DC, in order to put him on a pedestal, as they have, they had to kind of clear the mess away, and they had to put him above the fray. So long as they have him as a man who is critiquing capitalism and asking why there are 40 million poor people in America today, that doesn't put him above the fray. That inserts King into our current discussion. Because there are still millions of poor people in America today, and nobody wants to, or nobody in the political class seriously wants to talk about that. To understand him as the man who called America the greatest purveyor of military violence in the world today, you would have to come to terms with America's foreign policy. And they're not going to do that. America, arguably, is still the greatest military purveyor of military violence in the world today. Or it plans to die trying if it's not. and kill us all in the process. And so during the anniversary of the March on Washington, it was stunning to see King and Obama and others, Obama, Clinton, and so on. And it was like it was on a split screen. And on one screen, they were talking about how wonderful King was and what a brilliant legacy and what a great man. Obviously forgetting that he was a pacifist. Because on the other screen, they were saying, will we bomb Syria? Why shouldn't we bomb Syria? Where is this red line? Those two things happened at the same time. And the only way that you can have that split screen and not blow your mind is if you forget the latter part of the 60s, when King applies the non-violence that he'd applied to the segregationists, when he applies it to the American American state. And so I'm going to end with a description. I was in December. I was in South Africa for Mandela's funeral, and it was intriguing to me the pace at which people will flee, the white flight from history, I call it, the pace at which people will flee from things that are even within memorable, you know, within living memory. And there was a poll that showed that roughly two-thirds of white South Africans thought that black South Africans were poor because they didn't try, because they made no effort, or because they were lazy. It's only been 20 years. And white America came to embrace King in the same way that most white South Africans came to embrace Nelson Mandela. Grudgingly and gratefully, retrospectively, selectively, without grace, but with considerable guile. By the time they realized that their dislike of him was spent and futile, he'd created a world in which admiring him was in their own self-interest. Because, in short, they had no choice. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.